Colonel Selby, tell your real one. Can you tell me, first of all, how and when you came to be in the services?
Well, I was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Royal Marines in 1962, May the 1st, May the 1st, 1960. My father was eventually the Commandant General of the Royal Marines, but he wasn't then. He was a colonel in Washington, I think.
And what rank had you reached in the Marines by the time the Falkland crisis broke in the early part of 1982?
I was a major.
Can you tell me about what happened when you first received the news of the Falklands?
I first received the news, I'd listened to it obviously on the wireless for some time because I'd lived in the Falklands for a year and was interested in what went on. I was actually in London and at the university, London University, on a course of, I think it was called Oil, Islam and the Middle East, totally removed from the South Atlantic. But I got a call to return instantly to the Royal Marines at Poole, where I was commanding the Nanocroft branch of the Marines. So I jumped in the train and reported to my colonel, who's told me to grab all my charts and photographs and sketches and drawings of the Falklands and get to Plymouth to report to the Brigadier Julian Thompson and Commodore Michael Clapp, Commodore Amphibious Warfare. So I did.
Can you tell me how it was that you had come to spend a year in the Falklands?
Yes, I was. I commanded the detachment, Naval Party 8901, in 78 and 79. I was actually appointed there in 77, and we spent about 6 months doing pre-embarkation training. No, November, December, January, March. About 4 months doing pre-embarkation training. And during that year that I was down there, I had spent all my leisure time. We didn't actually have any leisure time because we were really on duty 24 hours a day. We were certainly at 5 minutes' notice to move 24 hours a day. But at what time I did have, I spent looking at the coastline, taking photographs, sketches, soundings, amateur hydrographic work. I'm a yachtsman. I'd lived on a yacht all my life, all my childhood. And as I was a yachtsman of some years, in the sense that I'd lived in a boat all my life, I spent all my free time doing these surveys, amateur hydrographic work, and I enjoy painting. So I was painting the local scenery, the beaches, the headlands, the wildlife. But I was also, of course, becoming a reasonably senior person in the Lanercraft branch of the Royal Marines, although I was then only a captain, or actually about the most senior captain of the Marines. And before we'd left England, I'd been asked by the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office to rearrange or to rewrite the concept of operations and the standard operating procedures for the defence of the Falklands. And one small section of that was the requirement to find a beach to which some of my men could go with pre-dumped communications equipment and food and weapons on an invasion taking place, from where they could report back clandestinely to the Ministry of Defence, and if necessary lead in and brief an advance force of special forces. So I had to look at some beaches to see if they were suitable for that. But I never told, obviously, the islanders or the governor that I was looking at beaches for that, because that would have led to all sorts of rumours, the islanders being extremely sensitive about the prospects of invasion. So I had to tell everybody that I was doing my beach surveys for private work, which largely I was. But I was to get into a lot of trouble with the governor, who felt that I should have been doing something more military. But I had to stick to my story and accept the opprobrium, because it had to be a cover for that small section of the coastline that I was doing for real.
Do I understand you to say that you had to select a particular beach?
It was up to me which beach I selected. In the end, I selected a beach at Campamento Bay, which is on the north coast, just east of Salvador Waters. And It was never used in the end for reasons which I have yet to discover, but certainly in my time, if the invasion had occurred, my concept of operations approved at cabinet level had a small stay-behind party, unknown to the Argentinians or to the invader, making their way across country to that place, from where they would send burst transmissions back to the United Kingdom, telling the MOD and the Foreign Office exactly what had happened.
Why did you choose that beach?
It was reasonably easy to get to from Stanley overland. There were no bottlenecks that the enemy could have cut off if they thought we'd done that. And frankly, I don't think the Argentinians were very military anyway, or very professionally military, so perhaps they hadn't thought we'd have done that. But it was reasonably easy to get to. It was a good beach to bring in special forces from a submarine in advance of any planned major landing. There was good wildlife there for food, good water. It was on the north coast, which meant that they could probably, I'm not a communicator, but use sort of certainly direct their radio message rather than an omnidirectional thing, which might have been DF'd. I mean, I didn't understand these things, but the communicator on my in my team, writing from that point of view, it was a good place. And it was a very beautiful part of the world, where they could live for 3 weeks without being bored. Good beach, good sheltered beach for bringing in small rubber boats, which would have come from a submarine. Deep water, close offshore, all those sort of things.
So even in 78-79, the authorities in Britain had this in mind, that a landing might have...
I wouldn't give them that credit. I would give the MOD that credit. I'd give a small part of the sort of civilian side of the Ministry of Defence, if you see what I mean, that credit. I don't think I would give the Foreign Office that credit, because without going into great detail, only because it'll take hours and hours and hours, they really weren't actually with us in this business, and yet I was officially told to do it by the government, by the cabinet, and by the MOD, and at face value by the Foreign Office, but that's as far as it went. When we actually got to doing it, the Foreign Office representative from the islands, who was the governor, Mr. Jim Parker, certainly tried to prevent us doing any of this. So I wouldn't give the Foreign Office the credit of thinking that would be that the invasion was going to take place.
You say you got into his bad books. To what extent was that?
Well, he thought I shouldn't have been spending all that time, of course, surveying beaches, although I was doing it for military reasons. I couldn't tell him that. Although he was a governor and commander-in-chief, there are some things that you keep from governors and commander-in-chiefs, particularly loquacious governors as he was. And I felt that he, being a very staunch servant of the Foreign Office, I had been warned by my contacts in England and in a department called Defence Intelligence 4, DI4, that he probably was only prepared to pay lip service to the MOD, straight British government's rather more robust defence of the islands. And that proved to be true. He, in the end, really tried to thwart all the aspects of the new concept of operations that I was invited by the MOD and the government to put into practice. And it's a long and convoluted story, which I, if I may say so in this interview, would suggest you wait till my book comes out, because it is actually quite a complicated story. And I'm not suggesting I am particularly right, but it's certainly my perceptions were that the Foreign Office on the spot, in other words, the governor, large part of the Foreign Office in England, were not in step with the MOD and the British government.
But was it just a mild ticking off from him?
Oh, it was pretty regular throughout the year that I was there. But it affected all sorts of other things. He wanted my wife to spy, and I use that word on purpose, in the sort of civil... The social side of Stanley, and my wife refused to do it. And as a result of that, I think he distrusted me. I think large part of it was chemistry. I don't think even in the best of things, circumstances, I would have got on terribly well with him. He was a delightful person, socially. And I think he probably thought I was too, socially, but professionally, we were poles apart. And it showed. I certainly didn't approve of some of the things he did, but I was a very junior servant of the system. Although I was answering, of course, to some extremely senior people in England, which he was not. And so you can imagine that it caused all sorts of complications.
To what extent in that year that you had in the Falklands in 78, 79, did you feel that an Argentinian invasion was impending?
Oh, that's easy to answer. It was a subject of conversation 24 hours a day. And I'm not being dramatic. Every single time you went to a party or you met people, it wasn't a question of if, it was a question of when and how. And I make this point very clearly in my book. And just for the record, it's called Reasons in Writing. It will be published by Leo Cooper in spring 93. And I make this point very strongly, that people in England, even in the MOD, and therefore on my side, as it were, who had decided that this new look should take place, didn't appreciate that there was a much more important reason behind it than even perhaps they realised. For instance, before I arrived, the Royal Marine Detachment's job was to, on an impending arrangement, was to run out into the hills and play guerrilla warfare and sort of report back by some means, unspecified means. Well, I was told to write the concept of operations whereby we stayed and fought, but one small party, which is my idea, I wasn't actually told to do it necessarily, to stay behind and do what I said from this little beach. Whilst I think in England that concept was... yes, I mean, we were told to take up that concept. I didn't think it was because anybody thought there was going to be an invasion instantly. In the islands, that paradoxically was their thought. And they were delighted when they heard. But of course, the Royal Marines that were going to do this were still the same 40 guys that were going to run out into the hills. And there's no way you can defend Stanley with 40 guys, so we had to think of that very carefully. But to come back to your question, it was, and people don't believe me, and I've always had a trouble with what I call second-hand hindsight by reporters and MPs and all sorts of people who've been there since the war, who assume that before the war it must have been the idyll, and there was, which is absolute rubbish. If none of them had been there before the war, and they simply can't believe that before the war there was this paranoia. And actually, paranoia is the wrong word. It was a very genuine and, in the end, of course, proved correct fear. And it was the subject of continual conversation. And it was quite obvious to us down there that the Argentinians were up to no good. They had arrested six Russian ships, fishing ships on the high seas. They had, in effect, they had removed their ambassador as a result of the Southern Thule thing. They had sent a task force which turned back. Mr. Callaghan had actually sent a submarine and two frigates and a tanker in 77. They had invaded Southern Thule, a fact which was kept from public until a year and a half later. They were sending in their aircraft to the islands, which when I joined the islands. Every time an aircraft came in, it had more pilots on board than was necessary. They used to do circuits and bumps with 15 pilots in the aircraft. It was quite clear that they were gaining information and practice and intelligence. And it was obvious to me. And this isn't hindsight. And my reports back, which I have copies of here, to DI4 and to the MOD, and which I refer to in my book, make it quite clear that even in those days it was a phenomena that wouldn't come to any surprise to the islanders.
So if they had invaded whilst you were there in 78, 79, did you anticipate that there would have been a bloody fight?
Those were our instructions. I think we'd have ended up with 42 dead Marines on the beach. Because we had nothing with which to defend the islands. They make these rules, which I agreed with, but then when I said, right, to do this, to change our role from running into the hills to being an intelligence-gathering guerrilla warfare system, to fighting, but then you've got to give us defence weapons and offensive weapons, mortars, mines, barbed wire, explosives to crater the airfield. Good communications, because we couldn't communicate with England 12 hours of every day. From about 8 o'clock in the evening onwards till 8 o'clock in the morning, we were totally incommunicado with the rest of the world, apart from some radio hams. So I said, yes, fine, you know, we will rewrite your concept for operations. And I did, and they were approved at cabinet level and by the chiefs of staff. But to meet that new concept, we required, of course, thousands of Marines. We weren't going to get theirs, but we required enough equipment to make the Argentinians stop and think. And my idea was we would force them to fight in standing. If they didn't stop at the beach, having, like all tripwires, you only have to have one man killed, or you know, you only need a small amount to allow escalation. But escalation is all right in the central front, but it's pretty pointless down there when escalation by Britain is going to take 3 weeks to arrive. So we were really aiming, or likely to end up with 42 dead Marines along the tripwire. However, it might make them sit back and think. What I did think would make them sit back and think was that if they had to fight in Stanley amongst the civilians, they weren't coming to... they thought they were coming to relieve an oppressed people, and that all the hidden blue and white flags would be waved the moment the Argentinians arrived. And so, therefore, I assumed, with the governor's help, I mean, the governor and I weren't at loggerheads the whole time, and he knew I had to go ahead with this study. And we assessed that if they thought they were going to have to fight us amongst the civilians, they might stop, because the last thing they want to do was to kill a civilian, because they were coming to relieve them as friends. So we hoped they would stand back. So that was behind a large part of the philosophy of the new concept for operations, which I wrote and had approved at cabinet level.
Now, I interrupted your story in 82 with you having got the news and headed down to meet Julian Thompson, I think you said. Mm-hmm. Could you pick it up from there, please?
Yes, I met Julian in Hermes House in Plymouth, Stenhouse, at Mount Wyatt's. And Julian, who knew me anyway, and I had great friends, great personal friends, he was the only person I'd ever lent my yacht to, said, tell me all you know about the Falkland Islands, Ewan. I said, no, I'm damned if I will, unless you make me a promise. And he asked me what the promise was, and I said that you take me with you. The last thing I wanted was to give him 3,000 slides and 150 sketches and all my charts, for me to see the end of them. I was quite clear that if they were going to go, I would have to go with them. And he said, oh, well, don't worry about that, you're coming. Now, tell me all you know. Well, all I knew was going to take considerably longer than the sort of 10 minutes he thought he'd planned. So having given him the briefest of briefs, about 10 minutes worth, I then went away and produced a rather more lengthy brief, which wasn't difficult because I'd already lectured on the islands about 100 times. They were probably then not quite as many, and I've now given about 300 or 400 lectures on the islands. But I'd certainly given quite a few lectures on the islands, probably 60 lectures, to do with the ecology or the wildlife or the birds. I mean, to all levels, to members of the Foreign Office, to the officers' messes, to various yacht clubs from the sailing point of view, to schools from the wildlife point of view. So it wasn't difficult to produce a rather more formal brief for Julian, because, I mean, I had it written down, dozens of them written down. So I came back and did that for him later on that evening. And the next day I produced a map, which I haven't actually got here. It's with the Imperial War Museum, on which I just scribbled in felt-tip pen all the likely beaches on East Falkland, and well, which one of them was San Carlos, with all the distances by sea and by land. And I penciled in arrows, the sensible routes from San Carlos to Stanley, both north and south, and from various other places. And so that was really the end of the first and second day. I then went with him to brief the Commander-in-Chief Fleet, Admiral Fieldhouse, the next day, or the day after. And I went with him to brief, or debrief, Rex Hunt and the Royal Marines when they came in. And then on the 6th of April... Again, it's in my book, and I'm very bad at it, but I think it was the 6th of April, I joined him with his staff. I mean, the whole time was spent briefing him and discussing and briefing the brigade officers and briefing Commodore Michael Clapp, briefing the SAS, briefing the SBS, briefing individually all the commando COs, and Hugh Pike, CO of 3-Para. So it was a pretty busy time. But anyway, I think it was the 6th of April, I flew off to join Fearless with Julian and his staff in the English Channel, and we were away. And it was tremendously exciting. And I'm one of those people who, unpopular though it might be, thoroughly enjoyed it. It's not popular to enjoy going to war, and certainly I was terrified on occasion. I was miserable on occasion. I was frightened, cold, wet. But overall, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And the reason why I thoroughly enjoyed it was because I was going back to a place that I knew and loved, with which I was having a love affair anyway, the islands, that is, not the people. And so there was a very real purpose to my involvement. It wasn't purely military. And many people went down there, to them it was a purely military job, and the sooner they got on, got it over with, the better, and they can get back to doing something else. But to my mind, there was a much greater perspective to my involvement, and I did enjoy it. And I enjoyed it professionally, and I enjoyed all the boating, even though I was frightened, but then I enjoy going to sea in a gale, knowing I'm going to be frightened. That doesn't mean to say that sometimes during it I wish the hell the thing would stop, and we could all come back. But, like many, I was determined to see it through, and if it took as long as it took, so be it. But in the end I ended up thoroughly satisfied and thoroughly content, and reckoning I'd had a thoroughly professional and personally enjoying time.
Which ship did you go down in?
In Fearless.
What was that voyage like?
Oh, fine, but I mean busy. And I spent all my time briefing. And right at the very beginning, in fact, on that first night or the first morning at sea, I suddenly realized already that I was going to have to be very careful about how I discussed the islands, because it was very easy to be tremendously subjective. And for instance, there were two places where I suggested a landing couldn't take place. There was no military reason why a landing couldn't take place, but one of them was the only king penguin colony in the islands, and the other was my most favourite island, and I didn't want to see either of them destroyed by war.
Which were they?
Well, the beach was Volunteer Bay on East Falkland, and the island was Carcass Island off West Falkland, which at some stage might have been used as an aircraft carrier, a stone aircraft carrier, but some strips there, which would have been presumably the object of Argentinian attention. But I realised that first day, as did Julian and Mike, that if I became part of the planning team, I would find it very difficult to give objective advice. So we agreed that I wouldn't be part of any planning team at that stage. I was there purely as a question and answer machine. I would answer questions and I would describe factually, and I would not know what was behind the question, so that I just, with a clear conscience, could give objective answers. If I'd known what was behind some of the planning ideas at that stage, I'd have subconsciously, and perhaps even consciously, falsified some of the answers. As I did with Volunteer Bay, tell them that it was the most god-awful place to carry out a landing, because I wanted to protect the wildlife. Well, that's no way to go to war.
So your work on the voyage down was just briefing everybody?
Briefing. But there were other sides to it. I wrote a 7-page document on survival, which was issued, I think we cut it down to 5 pages in the end, I couldn't cut it down any less than that, to every single man in the task force on survival. Survival being a two-edged weapon. I mean, you want to survive, and sometimes you don't want to be seen, sometimes you want to be seen. So there are ways of looking after yourself without being seen. Of course, there are ways of attracting attention in the islands which wouldn't necessarily be obvious unless you knew some of the local tricks. So I wrote these survival notes, where to find food, where to find water, how to hide, how to bring attention to yourself, For instance, the bears would always congregate around a man lying on the ground, which would draw attention to if you wanted to be found. But sometimes you didn't want to be found if you were escaping and evading. So there were two edges to a lot of what I wrote. There was that. Because I have a sense of humour, and I felt that people, sure, we were embarked upon a very serious business, but on the other hand, you have to leaven this with a wider perspective. And so alongside all the black and white silhouettes of enemy aircraft and enemy weapons and enemy ships, I painted and ran off, without anybody knowing, dozens of copies of black and white sketches of the whales and the birds and the dolphins and the penguins, and stuck them up as recognitions, silhouettes, with a little reminder that we ought to remember that beyond all this there is a saner world waiting to be released, as it were, freed.
So how did you get, what was the method of getting rid of the birds if you didn't want to be spotted?
Oh, well, I mean, you just had to go where the birds weren't, or hide. The moment if you wanted to be spotted, of course, birds would follow. And actually, a wounded man, they could certainly attack you. Getting away from the birds isn't that easy, to be honest, because the birds are everywhere. But I could explain where there were great bird colonies, if you didn't want to be seen, you shouldn't go anywhere near them because they would be disturbed.
So you mean these were carrion birds looking?
Oh, there certainly are carrion birds. Yes. Yes, I'm not suggesting they shouldn't attack a huge... Well, no, I've been attacked there, I mean, by the red-backed buzzard. And again, without going through the whole sort of range, there are some vicious birds. There's only one vicious animal, and that's the sea, the leopard seal. And I explained about how to approach him and what to do with him if you killed him, because he's tremendously useful. But you've actually got a copy of my survival notes up in the Imperial War Museum in one of the cabinets. Although I think only some of the pages, not all of them. But I mean, a leopard seal, for instance, his claws make tremendous flinging knives. His teeth you can turn into fishing hooks. His blubber you can cook with, eat his flesh, use his skin to make a hide or clothes, dry his intestines to make rope or fishing line. His eyes contain vitamins, his eyeballs. So, I mean, there's quite a lot you can do with a leopard seal. Poor leopard seal, but there you are.
What did you do once you got to Ascension Island?
Well, Ascension Island, I continued the briefing. I then didn't have to fly around the fleet by helicopter, which I obviously had to do at sea, but I would go by small boat. And I went across and lived in Canberra for a bit. I can't remember for how long now. Probably a week or so, briefing everybody on board there. And I visited all the ships there. There was a ship called the AES, a civilian ship, with a Norwegian captain called Captain Scrivener, if I remember rightly, on her way down. And surprisingly, on board were all the mortars and the defensive stores that I'd asked for three years before. So that showed how long it took for